supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show is a special membership drive edition of Voices, and we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews. Back in 2006, two world-famous advocates for tolerance and justice joined us right here in WHYY's Civic Space for an evening of conversation. Holocaust survivor Gerda Weissman-Klein and Alabama civil rights activist Morris Dees spoke about their lives and their work. Let's hear from Gerda Weissman-Klein first. In this part of our interview, she described life under the Nazi regime. Your story starts in Poland when the Nazis invaded your town. You were 15 years old. You had your family, your beloved brother, age 19. Tell us what happened prior to that horrible day. What was your family like? What were their values, their dreams?
Well, in retrospect, my family seems absolutely ideal. Looking back, I don't think my parents could have been as saintly as I remember them. I think it must have rained in Poland occasionally. But I think of my childhood of absolutely sunny. And I went to school and I thought my life will go on like that forever. And then on the morning, to be exact, at 9:10, the morning of September 3rd, 1939, a Sunday, a beautiful day, the world I knew and loved and was a part of was irrevocably destroyed. I endured first about 3 years from 1939 to 1942, from the time I was 15 till 18. My brother was taken away immediately. I stayed with my parents, first in the basement of our home, later in a very bitter ghetto. And I had just turned 18 when I was separated from my parents, never to be seen them again, on a journey of slavery, to slave labor in concentration camps, which lasted for 3 years. There was another dimension which lived there, which gave one hope for the ultimate goodness of humanity. And that is the love, the friendship, the caring and the sharing which existed, which gave one hope for the ultimate goodness of humanity.
Tell us about the woman in the slave labor camp, the German woman.
The German woman's name was Frau Kugler, and it was the first camp we came into. And I remember when the gates were closed, it was such a finality, and we were captive. And she came. She really did not have a resemblance to a human face. She looked like a bulldog, and her voice was a screeching, horrible voice. And I said, "Oh my God, we are going to be doomed with her here." And she really pinned a lie to the lips of all those who said they had no choice. No doubt she was picked by the Gestapo to be in charge of us by her demeanor, but she was a very kind, caring human being. Nobody was sent to Auschwitz. As a matter of fact, she dragged me one day to the factory when I and two other of my friends were excused. We were running a high temperature, and Lindner, this famous horrid person who, when he came to a camp and found anyone not working, to send him immediately to Auschwitz, she dragged us to the factory, literally. She put my looms in motion, and she said, "Pull yourself together. Today it's life or death." And she was carefully watched, no doubt, being in the position that she was in. But she showed a degree of humanity which gave me hope that perhaps not all of them are evil.
When you were taken to the labor camp, people in the community stared at you with hatred in their eyes. You were a part of that community. You had been a part of that community. And then in very short order, you were the subject of hatred. You were a 16-year-old girl. How did you understand being hated for who you were? How did you...
It's very difficult to explain that, you know. I cannot say that I was always raised with this sort of thing, but I lived in Poland. When I was going to school, I always had a little bit of a flair for writing. And twice a year we could write an essay, which, you know, and if it was chosen, it was published in something similar to what we have here, the scholastic things. And lo and behold, one day I won. And of course, it was great rejoicing. My God, you know, I was republished and everything Polish there and so on. And a few months later, when there was another time, it was usually twice a year, my father took me for a little walk. And on the walk, he said to me, doesn't you think coming about to write another essay? And I said, yes. And he said, you better don't try too well. It wouldn't do for a Jewish girl to win twice. And I never thought, why not? If I'm a good writer, why not? You know, you assume to think that you didn't make waves, you know, you didn't push yourself forward, you accept that role, sort of in good grace, yes, Papa, you're probably right, I shouldn't do a good essay. And I suppose that this attitude must have helped them when the Nazis came. But, oh, my God, did it change when I came here.
What changed? You didn't come to this country with courage to speak.
No. But I must mention, for the benefit of those who do not know my story, that I was liberated by a young American when on the end of the death march, and he became my beloved husband of 56 years. And I remember when we landed in New York, when the wheels touched the runway, his arm was around me and he said, you have come home.
Gerda Weissman Klein's written several books, among them All But My Life. In 1998, she helped found the Gerda and Kurt Klein Foundation, which was formed to teach students about the importance of tolerance, respect, and responsibility through character education and community service. Well, on that same evening, we were joined by Morris Dees. He's one of the founders of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The center is internationally known for its tolerance education programs and its legal victories against white supremacists and other hate groups. Here, he describes the path that eventually got him involved in civil rights.
I left home, you know, to go to college. I wasn't a civil rights lawyer. I wasn't an activist. I left home to go to college to be a lawyer to make some money so I could buy some land that nobody could make me move off of so I could be a farmer. But I remember when I first got to college, the most striking example of thing that changed me was 1956. Actually, it was 1955. I started school, college. And that was the year that a court ordered the University of Alabama integrated. They ordered a young woman named Arthurine Lucy to be admitted, and when she arrived on the campus, there was approximately 10,000 people there to protest her being there, Ku Klux Klan, turning cars over in the streets, and the students were told not to go out of the classrooms, but I did. At that point, you know, we all believed in segregation. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't a liberal, I wasn't a conservative, it's just I believed in the way of life we had. But as I watched this young black woman walk across the campus towards the administration building with a priest walking beside her and a mob swirling around, throwing rocks and bottles and stuff, I backed up on the steps of the Union Building there on University Avenue in Tuscaloosa, and every feeling I ever had for the underdog came out, because that same young woman was just like the ones that I'd picked cotton with in the cotton fields.
Name those feelings.
Well, it was a sick feeling of watching a mob if nobody's ever seen a mob, see 10,000 people rocking Greyhound buses and turning cars upside down, is the mob has a mind of its own. That's one feeling. Secondly, I didn't want to be a part of that mob. I felt disassociated with them. And I also felt like I wanted to get out there and, you know, knock a few heads. You know, I wanted to protect her. I wanted to get in there and defend for her.
And the feeling was anger.
Well, it was anger. It was compassion for her. It was anger.
One of the feelings, I would imagine, back then and maybe in college, was in addition to compassion and outrage, maybe a sense of helplessness or impotence.
Possibly. I'm not sure about that. I didn't think about that. But I do know this, though, that I was a superintendent of the Baptist Sunday School. Everybody's Baptist in Alabama. And so I was married when I got to college, so I was superintendent of the married Sunday school. And it was a big church with a couple of thousands, the university's big church there. And so they let me be the superintendent of the Sunday school. And so what you did when you had your Sunday school, you first went together in a big group and you read a few Bible verses and had a little devotion, and the people went to their classes. Well, this was the Sunday after Arthurine Lucy had been rejected. She was rejected. And I remember starting off the thing saying, I'll read something from the Bible. And so I read them from somewhere in John. I've kind of disassociated from the Baptist, no pun in there, but since. So I said, you know, in 1 John, in this devotion, I said, you know, in the Bible it says, how can you love God whom you've never seen, yet you hate your neighbor that you see? And everybody's saying, amen, that sounds good. And then I said, this last week, we rejected Arthurine Lucy from the University of Alabama, and we don't even know who she is. We never met her. And when I said that, everybody in the room's head dropped. You know, I mean, they really were not happy about that. And so when we went on about the class, well, that week, the minister of the church, a very big church, came to my marriage student apartment at the University of Alabama and said, you know, we've decided to make some changes in the Sunday school. You're a very fine person, and your preacher at your little Baptist church back home said you'd be a good person to have up here. But we think that we need a person with a little more experience. And he never mentioned that incident. And I was relieved of being superintendent of the Sunday school just like that.
You're telling your story to a psychologist, and I take a slant on it that I'd like to pursue.
Sure.
That you got up in front of this church, and nobody else would, I don't think. Certainly nobody else did. And it speaks not just to your vision of injustice, but it speaks to something inside of you. It speaks to your tolerance of being different, of being alienated. It speaks to your tolerance of standing alone. You've spent a good deal of your life, of your work, standing alone. It's painful.
I don't want to interfere with your psychoanalysis here, but
sorry.
But
I don't have a comeback line.
You know? Well, you know, I'll have to tell you this. You know, I don't think that to me, maybe then, maybe now, I don't know what devil made me do it. Maybe I've always been a lawyer at heart, but I don't think that I have a greater feeling than standing up in a situation, you know, that I think is right, that I'm representing somebody or defending somebody or some cause that I really truly believe in.
Well, we just heard excerpts from my conversations with Holocaust survivor and author Gerda Weissman Klein. And the one you just heard was with civil rights lawyer Morris Dees. You can hear all of these interviews in their entirety at whyy.org/91fm/voices. These interviews were with some amazing people, and you're not going to hear them anywhere on the dial but on public radio, right here on WHYY. And if you value that, if you value this kind of thoughtful discussion, give us a call, 888-345-9499. It is our fundraiser, and we depend on your phone call, your kindness and generosity, and your support. 888-345-9499. Right now, waiting to join the conversation is my dear friend and our executive producer, Mike and Scott. Mike and hi.
Hi, Dan. Thank you.
Sure.
That was really an amazing evening, and I think back to it very often. It was just such a crowd of people. WHYY members were literally just crowded into our civic space to listen to this conversation between you and Gerda and Morris. And if you value this kind of storytelling, if you value being able to hear things and to actually take the time to get somebody's story, to find out what motivated a Morris Dees to dedicate his entire life to this cause, if you value that kind of storytelling, give us a call now, because it is only because of your support that we can do it. I'm here with Susan Polinko, who is, of course, in charge of our children's service here at WHYY, and we've done a lot of collaborating with Voices in the Family and your department, Susan. And you're also a big Dr. Dan fan.
I am a Dan fan, I have to confess. And I actually think in that last piece, it was the first time I've ever heard Dan not have a witty comeback.
Yeah, that doesn't happen often.
That doesn't happen often. But what does happen often is you can hear Voices in the Family every week on WHYY-FM. And when you hear Voices in the Family, you hear the original voice of Dan and the original voices of his guests and the kinds of topics that he treats. And all of those things, in my mind, are a worthy effort, and they are worthy of your time and effort and your money. So give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, or you can go online to whyy.org. If you turn to Voices in the Family every week, it's important that you help step forward and make it possible.
And you know, Susan, when I'm out in the community, a lot of people tell me that they've had what they call Dr. Dan moments. It's like the driveway moment, but it's a Dr. Dan moment where they listen to the show and all of a sudden they had a profound insight into something that's been going on in their life, or maybe something that's troubled them for years. And I've had people tell me that they sat in their car and they cried,
yeah,
because they just realized something, or they had such just a moment. And if you've ever had a Dr. Dan moment, I do want to hear about it, but I want you to make a pledge right now and put kind of your support behind all that great information that you've been getting. So don't just tell us about how much you love the show. Actually put your dollars behind it. Make that call. Get involved. Because that's the only way that we can do what we do here.
Put your money where your moment is.
That's right.
That's what I would say. And we have a mini goal this hour of 32 calls, and we're just about 3 or 4 calls into that. We really need to hear from you. Since you're listening to Voices in the Family, it seems obvious the next step would be to pledge your support for this kind of programming. Now, a number of ways we have of saying thank you. At the $100 level, you can get Dr. Dan's hardcover book, Learning from the Heart. It's an excellent book. It's called Lessons on Living, Loving, and Listening. And that is the one thing that really strikes me about Dr. Dan, is what an amazing listener he is. And if you've had one of those Dr. Dan moments, one of those lightning bolts, like, oh my God, that explains so much about yourself or other people, those are the kinds of insights you gain from listening to Voices in the Family. Those are the kinds of things that you need to help step forth and support. So 1-888-345-9499, or go online to whyy.org. Become a member.
And over the years, Susan, we've had some very big-time players on the show, some famous people, people who do interviews all the time. And it's so nice, so many times we get an email after the show where people say, you know, I give interviews all the time, but this was really different. I felt that you understood my work, that you really, you know, brought something out. And that's the kind of thing that makes Voices in the Family special.
And you're so unique.
It's very unique. Give us a call at 1-888-345-9499. Make this show possible. Also think about the longevity of Voices in the Family. We've been here for way over 20 years now, which is
true.
A great thing. But all those years, people have stepped forward and they've made contributions to the station and thus kept the show going, kept the show strong. long. So right now, it's your turn. If you've never supported Voices in the Family before, if you've never become a member of WHYY, think about it and do it now. 1-888-345-9499. Susan, we have another amazing interview coming up, so I want to just wrap this up here because you will hear something great with John Kabat-Zinn. You can reach us online at whyy.org or again, give us a call at 1-888-345-9499, and we thank you so much for your support.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and sponsors a public lecture by John Kabat-Zinn, the founder of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, on the evening of February 6th. Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family will interview Dr. Kabat-Zinn following the lecture. Details about this and other programs featuring mindfulness-based tools for individuals, groups, and businesses at pennhealth.com/stress or 215-615-2775.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. For those of you who have pledged, thank you. Well, today is a special membership drive edition, and we're listening to some of our favorite interviews. In 2005, we invited world-renowned mindfulness teacher John Kabat-Zinn to join us here at WHYY for a discussion of his work and his teaching. Well, he accepted, and hundreds of WHYY members crowded into our civic space to hear the conversation. He's written several books, among them Full Catastrophe Living, and his most recent one is Coming to Our Senses. I started the interview by asking John why we lead such busy lives even though we don't seem to enjoy doing it.
We believe our thoughts that describe the world to us without examining them. And I think it was, sometimes I've heard it attributed to Aristotle, sometimes to his teacher Plato, the unexamined life is not worth living. I mean, it lies at the absolute heart of our Western civilization. And yet, as a rule, we're not encouraged or even taught how to examine our lives, especially in a way that's friendly and not vicious and critical. So this is actually an acquired skill. And while you say, yeah, it's hard or challenging to live in that way, I would kind of also respond, well, yeah, but what else is there to do? In a sense, you know, quoting that great yogi Bob Dylan, if you're not busy being born, you're busy dying. And it may be that we're busy dying much more than we're busy being born. And I'm not talking about being reborn. I mean, just born to each moment. And in a sense, it's a choice whether we know we're making it or not. And when we are willing to inhabit the moment, one of the things that happens so amazingly is we do wake up, because it turns out, it sounds like a truism, but it's one of the most profound fulcra around which human beings can heal and transform. The present moment is the only moment in which we are ever alive. So if we can learn how to actually inhabit the present moment with the full repertoire of our capacities, and that doesn't mean just colored by thought, although we're not excluding thought from it, but with this kind of greater awareness, that examined life, then we have many more choices for how to navigate the ups and downs and the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune in ways that are empowering, transformative, healing, and nurturing of what I would call well-being or happiness. And that in the midst of all the stress, it's not like, oh, I got to get rid of all the stress and then that kind of thing can happen. No, it's that you use it all as kind of like fertilizer to nourish the soil of your own heart. So, and that's a discipline. It's a practice. It's not just a good idea.
So let's start with the process. When I learned mindfulness meditation 7, maybe 8 years ago now, there was a woman in the course who was terminally ill, and she appeared so. And I said to her, why would you take an 8-week course where you have to practice every day, where it takes a good 60, 70 years to get good at it? And at least, and she said to me, all my life, wherever I was somewhere else. And she said, in the time I have left, I want to be where I am. I want to read the opening quote from your brochure. Meditation is not for the faint-hearted, nor for those who routinely avoid the whispered longings of their own hearts. What's so hard about it?
I want to just linger for a moment in what you said before you read that quote, because the woman who was like terminally ill, if you will, she's basically affirming something that we all know, and that is, it doesn't matter what's already happened and over. The only possibility that we have for really living authentically is to drop in here and now. And actually, if you think about it, we all learned in elementary school that if you take a line that's like a foot long and you take a line that's an inch long, and I were to ask you, how many points, are there more points in the line that's a foot long than in an inch long, what would you say? It's the same, right? We've all taught that they're both an infinite number of points, and so there's as many points in a line that's an inch long as in a foot long. That's hard for the thinking mind to understand because we're not intimate with infinities, even though there are many infinities associated with our own being. So think of it this way. Take this woman who is going to die at some point, just like everybody else. Between now and the time that she was going to, between the time you asked her that question, the time she was going to die, there were actually an infinite number of moments, no matter how short or long that time was by the clock or the calendar. If she were to embrace her moments, good, bad, or ugly, and live them fully, what I heard her saying in response to you is, that is no longer a kind of luxury. That is an absolute necessity. That in some way, I need to take care of living and let the dying take care of itself, rather than worrying constantly about the dying and in the process miss the living because it doesn't conform to the story we want to tell ourselves about how we'd be happy if only it were happening some other way.
Let's make this discussion a little bit less abstract. Could you teach us what mindfulness is for a couple minutes?
What we're talking about sounds totally trivial. Just hear what's here to be heard, see what's here to be seen, taste what's here to be tasted, feel what's here to be felt, know what's here to be known without the colorations of inaccurate thinking. What's the big deal? Well, it turns out it's very, very hard to do. And a lot of time we only hear what we want to hear, we see what we want to see, we're very conditioned and habitual. And so one has to actually train to cultivate that in-touchness that in a way is our birthright, but most of the time we are seriously asleep at the wheel around. So we live in a kind of delusion that we're walking down the street, but we're really walking down the street in our head, and we're not seeing or feeling the air or whatever. So meditation really is about paying attention. That's all. There's nothing particularly magical, particularly mystical, particularly Eastern, Japanese, Tibetan, you know, Indian. It's about paying attention. It's completely universal. You don't have to give up your belief systems, adopt some other belief system, shave your head, wear robes, chant in the street, funny languages. It's just an invitation to drop in on yourself and to inhabit the moments that are ours to live, and there's only this moment. Most of the time, if you pay attention, your mind is someplace else. It's in the future. Pay attention to what's on your mind. Most of the time, it's either worrying or planning. Or it is in the past, blaming, you know, potentially blaming who's to blame for why I'm so miserable now. or how great it was in the good old days and compared to now. And I like to dispel the notion from the very beginning that meditation is about getting anywhere else or being better than you already are. First of all, it's impossible. The only way, the only place you can be is where you already are. So it's not about getting someplace else. It's about being where you actually are. And it's not about becoming better or self-improvement. It's about recognizing your wholeness right here, right now.
I can't think of anything more important to listen to right now, right here, with what's going on in our culture, what's going on in the larger world. These are profound words. These are important ideas. Jon Kabat-Zinn is a renowned teacher of mindfulness. He's the founder and director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. On Friday, February 6th, this Friday, I'll be speaking with John at the Zellerbeck Theater at the University of Pennsylvania. For more information on tickets, check out my website at drdangottlieb.com. Listen, if this kind of programming is important to you, if you find people like Jon Kabat-Zinn important and valuable, you're not going to hear it anywhere else but right here. So if that's valuable to you, give us a call at 888-345-9499. Show your support for this kind of programming, for this program, and for WHYY. Again, that's 888-345-9499. I'm joined by Mike and Scott, our executive producer, and my dear friend, and Susan Palinko, who's also a dear friend. She's not my executive producer, but probably could be pretty easily.
What, are you trying to replace me already?
No, sorry.
Yeah. 1-888-345-9499. Is our number. Please give us a call here at Pledge Central to support Voices in the Family. I remember that evening when Jon Kabat-Zinn joined us here at WHYY's Independence Foundation Civic Space, and I thought the station was going to burst because so many people crowded into the space all wanting to hear this conversation, and it was really, truly a magical evening. Hopefully you were there. If you weren't, become a member now, and you will be invited to future invitations and future events like the one we just heard from. 1-888-345-9499. Susan, we've had many great events with Dr. Dan here at WHYY where members came in and saw it all happen.
Yes, we have. We always love to work with Dr. Dan because he is so engaging and because he brings in the people, because people really do just react to Dr. Dan and in a lot of different places in their lives. And so I think it's really important for people to understand, for you, if you're listening, since you're listening, to understand that Dr. Dan is an enormous resource that we have here in the Delaware Valley, and it's kind of unparalleled, and you will not find a Dr. Dan in other places, so it's important that you step forward and show your support for Voices in the Family and for Dr. Dan Gottlieb. 1-888-345-9499 or go online to whyy.org. And you'll notice online, if you go to whyy.org and go to radio, you can also look at the immense archive that we have of Voices in the Family programs that you can enjoy at your leisure. And that's just another way in which we give back to you. But what we need you to do to right now is to give to us and show your support. It's important not that you just listen to Dr. Dan, but that you become a member as a result of that listening.
And so many people make use of our archives online. That's really a great service. And I remember, Susan, the time when I first started working on the show, when we did a program about menopause, and people were calling and calling and calling the station because they really wanted to hear that conversation again because there was so much information. And at the time, we didn't have the availability yet of the website where you could listen online, and I couldn't physically send tapes to everybody. So nowadays, just think about how easy it is. You go on our website and you can just listen again and again. You can send it to a friend, your friend in San Francisco, wherever they are, they can listen. And that's something that WHYY has added and is expanding every minute as we speak. Our website is growing. So think about that as you make your pledge of support at 1-888-345-9499 or online at whyy.org. We're not only a great radio station, we really every day aim to expand our services.
It's true, because Dr. Dan is not just on the radio, he's in person and he's online. So you can get to the information that you want to get at and listen to voices in a number of different ways. Now, we have a mini goal this hour of 32 pledges of support, and we have about 10, so we need to start cracking up at that, or cracking away, chipping away at that, at that goal. So the thing to do is pick up the phone, give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-9499, or go online to whyy.org. At the $100 level, you can get Learning from the Heart, the hardcover book by Dr. Dan, which came out a few years ago. It's a wonderful compendium of lots of different interesting topics and ways and perspectives of looking at life. It's a really wonderful gift, too.
1-888-345-9499. Get that book if you don't have it, or if you know a friend who would like this book. It's a great thing to make a pledge for a friend and give them the gift of membership to WHYY. Think about Voices in the Family for all the years that you've listened. Think back to the time when you listened to the show for the first time and you discovered it and you thought, wow, this is amazing. And then make that pledge of support, because there really isn't a program like this anywhere on the dial. There's plenty of shows that are self-help this and get better at that and do 10 steps of this. That's not what Voices in the Family is about. Voices in the Family is in-depth. It's conversations. It's just talking about what's going on without that constant need. I have to do something about it right now. I have to get better and organize my closet and make myself more miserable in the process. That's not what Voices is about. 1-888-345-9499. We really need to hear from our members, from our Dr. Dan fans out there.
There's lots of Dan fans out there because I know you're listening. And since you are listening, it's important that you step up and make a pledge of support. 1-888-345-9499. Or you can go online to whyy.org. We need to hit this goal in this hour, this mini goal that we have. And we're about 13 or 14 into it. So we need to get a little better, get a little nice little web ping there. So go to whyy.org, make a pledge of support online, or go to the phones and give us a call. 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-9499. We're going to go back to the program in just a few seconds, so you just have a little bit of time left. 1-888-345-9499. Or go online, check out the archive of Voices programs that we have online at whyy.org. 1-888-345-9499.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and sponsors a public lecture by Jon Kabat-Zinn, the founder of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, on the evening of February 6th. Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family will interview Dr. Kabat-Zinn following the lecture. Details about this and other programs featuring mindfulness-based tools for individuals, groups, and businesses at pennhealth.com/stress or 215-615-2775.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today is a special membership drive edition of the show, and we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews. Well, if you've been listening to the show for some time, you may know that I'm very fond of animals, and I've had many pets over the years. Great pets, I should add. And of course, I'm not alone. More than 64 million households in the United States have one or more pets. So we thought it would be interesting to take a look at our relationships with them. We were joined by Dr. Alan Beck and Jody Levine. Dr. Beck is director of the Center for the Animal-Human Bond at the School of Veterinary Medicine at Purdue University. Jody Levine is director of clinical social work at the Ryan Veterinary Hospital at the University of Pennsylvania. Dogs and cats are really quite different beasts. There was a wonderful cartoon in New Yorker a couple of years ago, and there was a dog and a cat laying in bed together, and the dog is reading Dogs Who Love Too Much, and the cat's reading Balls of Yarn Monthly, and the cat's saying, "I'm not aloof, I'm a cat, you idiot." And these are really opposite animals. I mean, you know, the dog's going to meet you at the door and the cat's going to meet you whenever they feel like it. And yet our devotion to them is the same. Jody?
Well, I think that both cats and dogs offer us something that other human beings can't give us. And whether or not it's a dog or a cat, some people prefer cats, some people prefer dogs. Whatever it is that they tend to like, they feel comforted by that. And you can't take away that connection or that bond that these animals offer us.
Alan, this relationship has developed since forever. When we were in caves, we had relationship with wolves, yes?
The feeling is we were always aware of animals, animals probably being the most important part of our environment. So the cave drawings are about animals and not anything else, because you have to know animals. You either so you'd have food or so you wouldn't be food. But we lived with them. And then once we started living in villages, we had places where there's trash and accumulation around 14, 15,000 years ago. That's when you start seeing the wolves coming around, people finding the puppies, the cubs, selecting the ones that stayed the youngest, the smallest, the most tractable, releasing the rest, or perhaps, you know, killing them or eating them, whatever. And that's really where we see a pattern of domestication. Once people were in one place and they could really learn to appreciate animals and kept them in one place and therefore had to feed them. And that is the whole evolution of tetanus. And that's really so we see it. And probably the original puppy domesticated wolves were used both for trash control and eating probably human waste as well as other waste, being barkers for other wolves and other people, and being a real focus of nurturing. I mean, lots of psychologists feel that one of the really motivations for the domestication was the sheer companionship, the joy that people get from taking care of and raising, whether it be plants or animals.
How did it evolve that some animals we take into our homes and care for, and some animals we eat?
That's actually a very good question. And by the way, there's some cultures that do both with the same species.
Well, with the same species.
Yeah, though you don't usually eat your own kind. So those cultures that say eat pig and also keep pig as pet, you don't eat your own. You might give it away. By the way, we sort of have an analogous situation here in even our own culture, in that we keep our dogs as pets and therefore use other dogs if they're going to, say, be used in research, which is a kind of eating. It's a kind of ecological transfer to use animals for research, because it's an adaptation for our survival. So what we do is we don't use pets for research animals. We really treat the same species as two different species. So that's one of the ways we do it.
And how do we make that disconnect, and what's it based on? I mean, after all, chickens are cute, you know?
Well, my theory is that we tend to be most connected to animals that are either cute, that is, maintain a pedomorphic or very juvenile appearances, animals that are social, because we're social too, and animals that are, or at least appear to be, intelligent. In other words, our favorite pets are the people that are animals that we wish, you know, even our companions were that way, cute, smart, and social. And so we tend to be, you're right, much more protective of the seals and dogs and cats that have that releaser in our in our guts, that this is an adorable younger animal, regardless of its real age.
You may have inadvertently offended a great number of chickens just now, but we'll just leave that where it is. Let's go to our calls. Irv, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had never had a dog until one was purchased for our son over 13 years ago. And I always thought people were kind of goofy when they got emotionally involved with their pets. No more. When the dog died, I had to have the dog put to sleep. He had cancer. We had him operated on, and then he just began to deteriorate. I think that I reacted more emotionally than when my parents died. I was borderline hysterical. Hell, the vet was crying at that point in time when I was with him for the final shot. And I've kept his ashes with the intent that they'll, now talk about goofy, that they'll come with me when it's my turn. That said, we still mourn the dog, and this has been now over 3.5 years ago. We still sit around, my wife and when my son visits us, the three of us sit around and talk about how the dog did this and how he would have responded to that. I doubt if we've ever gotten over that.
Irv, hold on for 1 minute. We've got an expert here who's going to address grief. But let me just ask you one yes or no question.
Sure.
You said you haven't gotten over it. Yes or no, would you like to?
Interesting question. I can't necessarily. It would be nice, but at the same time, yes, but at the same time, it might be almost as if one were doing a disservice to the dog, you know, forgetting the dog.
All right, so let's take that answer and turn to Jody, which I guess sets up your answer to.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say you're not silly or abnormal for having these emotions or feeling this way about your dog, for that matter. When sometimes people come to the group or I counsel clients who say, oh, I've never had a dog, I've never had a cat, and this dog touched my life and brought me so much happiness. And oftentimes they have a really difficult time when the animal passes away. Regarding euthanasia, that's a really, really difficult decision to make on behalf of your animal. And I think it comes down to, are you keeping your animal alive for yourself? Or are you keeping your animal alive for them? And unfortunately, a lot of pet owners do tend to keep their animals alive for themselves, and it's whether or not your animal is having quality of life. It sounds like in your situation, you did the right thing. Regarding what you're talking about, not being able to get over it and keeping the ashes and hoping that you're going to go, he's going to go along with you when you pass away, I think that we hold our animals very close to us. They offer us something that our human relationships don't. They give us something that we will never get from other human beings. So for us to want to take them with us is not silly.
Well, let me ask a question that hundreds of listeners might be wondering right now. When is it a problem, the grief?
I think that the grief is a problem when you're able to not function in your day-to-day life. But just you guys sitting around thinking about your dog and talking about him, that's not a problem. That is recognizing the good times that you had, even though you're sad to talk about them. I think it's an okay process. I think it's part of the grieving process. We don't want to forget our animals. We want to remember them. We want to keep them with us. I think that they do stay with us in our minds, in our hearts, and hopefully one day that we will be with them in some way.
Thanks, Irv. Thanks so much for your call. I experienced that with my dog. My daughter came and she and her colleague, both veterinary technicians, came when it was time to put my dog, Aldo, to sleep. And we brought our cat in, who loved Aldo. And it was one of the most painful things I've ever done in my life. I wanted, the second he closed his eyes, I wanted to scream, take it back, take the drug back.
Absolutely.
It was agony. Yeah, we do love these. We do love these beasts in very special ways, probably because they love us in the same way. You just listened to an excerpt from our show on our relationship with animals and pets. My guests were Jody Levine and Alan Beck. Beck is the director of the Center for the Human-Animal Bond at the School of Veterinary Medicine at Purdue University. Jody Levine's director of clinical social work at the Ryan Veterinary Hospital at the University of Pennsylvania. Hey, I want to give you a very important phone number to call. It's 888-345-9499. This is our fundraiser, and we turn to you, our listeners, you who we know value this show. We turn to you to help support it and to keep this show and this station alive and thriving. Again, the number is 888-345-9499. Give us a call. I'm going to pass it over now to Mike and Scott, our executive producer over at Pledge Central, along with Susan Palenko. Hey, guys.
Hey,
hey Dan.
Dan. What a great excerpt we just listened to, because it, at the same time, there were some very sad moments. There were also a lot of very funny moments. So I think that's the beauty of Voices, that it kind of encapsulates all of those emotions in 1 hour usually. You laugh, you cry, you feel better, you learn something, you might get a little mad at something. And at the end of the hour, we're all better people for it. If you appreciate Dr. Dan, everything that he brings to our region, then please give us a call right now at 1-888-345-9499. He's a very special guy, and I think we are very, very, very lucky on the station and in our region to have him right here with us to be our guy, our Dr. Dan.
It's very true, Mike, and Dr. Dan is a special person, and he brings his unique perspective to things, and that's a prime, this past piece we just listened to about relationships with animals is a prime example of the way he extends what he knows about human relations into other realms, and that, in my mind, being an animal lover that I am, I appreciate that. I could really relate to what they were talking about with the loss of an animal, and since you're listening, you've already made the choice to actually listen to Voices in the Family. So why not take that next step and become a member? 1-888-345-9499 or go online to whyy.org. We have a mini goal this hour of 32 calls. I believe we're about, we just need about five or six more. So we'd like to get that going. So go online to whyy.org and make a pledge online or give us a call, 1-888-345-9499.
Over the course of this hour, we've mentioned some great events that we've had in the past at WHYY, and there's one in our future. On Thursday, February 19th at 6:30 p.m., Dr. Dan invites you to come in for a presentation of Boomer Vision when he and his guests will talk about religious perspectives on aging. He has a great panel of different guests from all different religious backgrounds, so it promises to be a wonderful evening. It's free to WHYY and AARP members and $15 for non-members. So once again, being a member to WHYY really, really pays off. Membership begins at $50, and we're asking you just to think about for one moment all the value that you get from WHYY, those great events, just being one of the many bonuses when you become a member.
It's true, and the idea that you can attend an event and as a member you get free access to it, that's a benefit of membership. So that is another reason to make the case to really appeal to you to say it's time. It's time to become a member. 1-888-345-9499 or go online to whyy.org. This Voices program, the kinds of topics that you hear on Voices to me is I never walk away not learning something, and that's what I really like, whether I learn about how I can better interact with other people, how I can control myself, or how I can just learn,
or not.
But really, it's just I never walk away not having some little tidbit or piece of information that I might not have had previously. So if you value that kind of thing, if you feel that way, it's important that you give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, or go online to whyy.org. Help us meet this mini goal we have.
And we have a lot of great shows coming up over the next couple of weeks. For example, next week we're going to talk about relationships and how we can learn in a relationship to see it the way our partner sees it, rather than trying to convince the partner to see it our way, you know, to learn how we can help each other in that direction. And then we're going to have a whole series on the impact of the economy. Mm.